I'll be honest, I have not always been totally clear on what the dean of a college does exactly, and I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in that. But Julia Goodfox, a dean at Haskell, has made it part of her mission to let people in on the secret. She takes to Twitter with a passion, sharing what she thinks about, cares about, what she does on behalf of students at her tribal school. But she also tweets updates on Indians in the news, on Indigenous culture, issues people should be talking about. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we'll hear the story of Julia Goodfox, why she cares so deeply about tribal education, and what the conversations she starts on Twitter have to do with that. Julia Goodfox, good morning.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
You are the Dean of the College of Natural and Social Sciences at Haskell.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Love the question. I love the question. So in a nutshell, a dean helps with the day-to-day operations of a university, making sure that the doors are open, that students are earning their education, the professors are teaching. And then we're also responsible for long-term planning. Where do we see our college in the next 5 years, 10 years? And what kind of program should we be offering to our community? So it's both a day-to-day, but also being part visionary.
When you say that a dean makes sure that professors are teaching and students are getting an education, that is that's a big thing to make sure of. I mean, how do you make sure of that?
Well, with regards to our students, we want to make sure our students are having, at least at my college, what we call the Haskell experience. So we have students that are representing 140 tribes at a minimum every semester. They're coming in, and they're like college students everywhere. A lot of them are homesick. There might be some adjustments to living in Kansas. So we want to make sure at our small college that we can give them that Haskell experience. If they're having difficulty going to class, because we're so small, we're able to do a little bit more intrusive academic advising. Say, hey, how come? What's going on? What can we do to help you get into class? Doing professional advising, working with them with regards to their dreams and visions and how we can get there. And then with our faculty, we want to make sure that we hire faculty and employees that are really committed to the mission of serving Indian Country.
So when you talk about serving Indian Country and the Haskell experience, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. With regards to higher education, with our tribal colleges, a lot of people in the United States don't know that there are around 35 tribal colleges. There's one in Alaska, and the rest are in the lower 48. And so these tribal colleges, most of them are in rural areas. Haskell's an exception because we're in Lawrence, but most are in very small, isolated communities, and they offer accessible education both to American Indians and also non-tribal peoples. Haskell's an exception. We have two tribal colleges out of those 35 that only serve American Indians and Alaska Natives, and that's because of our treaty relationship with the United States.
And Haskell is one of those.
Yes, yes. So a non-tribal person can go to enroll and apply to any of the 33 tribal colleges, but for these two, Haskell and the one in Albuquerque, you have to be a citizen of an American Indian tribe.
So what drew you to Haskell? Was that part of it?
It kind of just fell into my lap. I don't mean to be flippant, but I was an undergraduate at the University of Oklahoma when I realized I wanted to work in higher education. So when I ended up at University of Kansas working on my PhD, I had heard that Haskell was looking for an adjunct in the English department. And I thought, well, I'll do this for a semester. And absolutely fell in love with it at the small college. At the time, my trajectory was to work at a state university. But the first day I walked onto campus, it felt like home.
Why?
I suppose that because it looked like me. That might be one thing. It felt like family. Being around tribal people just felt right. And we have a significant Native American population at University of Oklahoma. But that's a large university. And of course, University of Kansas, we don't have as many American Indians or other peoples of color. And so it was really nice to go to a smaller campus, find out you can still receive a quality education, even if it doesn't have the resources that a state university does. and that people really wanted to be there. It just felt home. It felt inviting. It's a very generous campus.
You have mentioned you were originally from Oklahoma, and you're part of the Pawnee Nation?
Yes. So the Pawnee Nation is a smaller tribe. There's about 2,500 of us. At one time, we numbered over 20,000. Some of our historians say it was even higher than that. Our territory ranged from Nebraska down to Oklahoma. Around 1875, we were forced, like many tribes, into Oklahoma. And that's where we've been since then.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own experience in the education system? Because you didn't come through a tribal college yourself.
No. In fact, I'm the first generation in my family. My siblings and I are the first ones who did not go to even an American Indian boarding school. So my great-grandmother went to Indian boarding school, my grandmother and my mother.
Is that sort of part of that whole history of, people being sort of alienated, really, from their own histories?
Exactly.
Through those systems?
Exactly. And so people who might not be familiar with that era of United States history, that was a period of time when the United States was working on colonization and even genocide. It does fall under definition, the UN definition of genocide, of forcibly separating children from their families, and in our case, from the tribes. So it was a way to destabilize their tribal communities. So when you think about that period of time in the late 19th century up through, let's say, World War II, all these children being separated from their families, think about the impact, the significance that had on the families and the tribes themselves. So when I was growing up, my mom would say, oh, I didn't have a mom like other people think of their mom. My mom was an institution. And I didn't understand that when I was younger. So my siblings and I were the first one who did not go to that type of boarding school. But of course, through the movements of the 1960s and 1970s, you see that these schools and these colleges become more American Indian focused. And so we get away from the colonization.
Can you explain that? What was that part of the civil rights movement?
Yes. So we can even go back into the 1950s. So people might be more familiar with African-American civil rights movements or Latino civil rights movements, women's civil rights movements during that period of time. But also American Indians were doing this as well. And we weren't as interested in civil rights as we were treaty rights. The United States has made all these treaties with American Indian nations. And we know that treaties are the law of the land, according to the U.S. Constitution. So American Indians, after World War II, we're starting to see if we could start having these treaty rights. So we had tribes out on the West Coast up in Washington State who started fishing, and the state was trying to prevent them from fishing on their lands. And it was very violent, very violent. There were American Indians that were shot at, that were jailed. And so you start seeing that movement there, and of course, similar to civil rights movements, it starts picking up and people start looking at how they can improve their quality of life.
And that translates to education.
Exactly.
And it sounds like turning institutions that had been used to assimilate Indians mm-hmm. to actually be more, communicate some kind of pride or service to that community.
Sure. I'm going to speak more about higher education and not kindergarten through 12th grade. But when you look at the history of colleges in the United States, so many we could say were almost anti-Indian. So when we have people that are in the United States government, these are college-educated people. When we look at the oil industry, these are college-educated people. And they were using their college education against Native peoples, against Indigenous peoples. And so when American Indians are going to college, still receiving that kind of colonized education that was very anti-tribal, very anti-community. So in the 1960s and 1970s is when you see the rise of the tribal college movement, and hence the 37 or 35 tribal colleges we have today. So, you know, when you attend these colleges, you're still going to learn algebra, you're still going to learn general biology, but the curriculum is going to be based on the community that it serves.
So for you, not having gone through that kind of education yourself, mm-hmm. What does it mean to you that these students who you serve as a dean at Haskell are having such a tailored kind of experience and surrounded by people? You said that it felt like home when you walked onto this campus in a way that your previous institutions maybe had not, where
yes.
you had worked, but I'm assuming also where you studied.
That's true. That's true. And I was fortunate in a way in that I did have professors that were wonderful mentors and that were always very respectful of my particular academic journey and were also keen on learning themselves about more about the American Indian history with the United States, because it's a history that is still not taught. And so when I look at the students today at Haskell, I just feel they are so fortunate, and they'll have an experience that I will never have because I did not attend a tribal college as an undergraduate or even a graduate student. And so I just think how much further along they are in their quality of their life. And
how so, though? I wonder what you feel you did miss out on.
That's a good question. And I don't know that I really have thought about it in depth. Even though I went to a mainstream education and went through that educational system, I think maybe what I had that perhaps others did not was I had a period of time where I had to go through a decolonial process myself. But we have to...
Wait, what do you mean by that exactly? What did it look like?
Well, when we think about... from an educational standpoint, I was fortunate in that I also had a good family, good tribal members. My tribe's very politically active, very, very activist focused. So I was fortunate in that regards. But there were times where I might have assumed that there was only one way of operating, that there was only one political system that we ought to have, because maybe I did not know my own history, and that there were other ways of being a political actor, that there were other ways of having representations of ourselves in movies or TV shows or on radio shows. And so just going through that process of, because I think many
of
us...
So you had maybe kind of internalized some
yes,
of those mainstream
yes,
messages.
Yes, that was exactly what I was... Yes. So... and I know that this is not only for American Indians to go through, it'd be for anybody in the U.S. Everybody in the U.S. needs to go through this, and not just American Indians.
What are some of the big questions that you and your colleagues wrestle with working in academia, specifically in a tribal college setting?
Well, similar to other colleges, we're contending with what's going on right now in higher education. There are perhaps an identity issues going on as we see some of the attacks going on from our elected politician. Why have what is the relevance of higher education? So going back and thinking about what is our role? What do we serve Lawrence? How do we serve Lawrence? How do we serve Kansas? And how do we serve Indian country, the United States, and beyond those geographical borders. So we're contending with that. What's our mission? Do we need to revisit this? And then along with other colleges, too, about funding, revenue streams, things like that.
You know, so I want to bring us back to this, the work you've been doing on Twitter. I mean, how does social media play into some of those questions that you are wrestling with? Questions about the relevance of a school like Haskell today?
Social media is one of the great inventions so far, and it really has the possibility, the potential to just broaden and open up our world. And I have learned so much from social media. And this starts from the days of MySpace, if any of our listeners remember MySpace. But people being able to connect so quickly like that. And it reminds me of when I was a child, those of you who grew up in the 70s, there was a show called Big Blue Marble, and there was that pen pal service. So social media, in a way, reminded me of that, being able to connect quickly. And my philosophy...
I do not remember this pen pal service, and I would like to know about it just briefly to understand what you're seeing as a precursor to social media.
Yes, yes. And so on Big Blue Marble, which was one of the Saturday morning shows, there it was... a way to introduce children to films from all over the world, just short little films, and there would be U.S. actors as well. And then about halfway through the show, they would say, hey, youngsters, do you want to make a friend around the world? And so you would send in your information, and they would connect you, and you would have a pen pal. And so it was very nice to meet people that way, or youngsters that way. And so when we start looking at the internet, we start looking at the early days of the philosophy behind the internet, when we're looking at these college young men, young women, college age, and those who weren't going to college, and the potential that they saw with computers and with the internet, and how they really saw a computer revolution. And we're talking back, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And so, you know, sometimes we go off path. We saw Jack on Twitter, the CEO, who's talking about these unintended consequences. When we're looking at these idealistic ways of how the internet's going to connect us, but how did we get from that to bots and some of the other negativity that's going on? But there's I'm a firm believer in social media, and I still use Twitter to my own philosophy as an educator is to have a borderless classroom. And I that was my philosophy when I was a professor, and now as an administrator, I still believe in that borderless classroom.
Define borderless classroom.
I think that no matter what college class we're taking, no matter what the topic is, regardless of whether it's chemistry, regardless of whether it's psychology, every topic that we study, whether we're at Harvard, University of Kansas, Haskell, that class needs to be directly relevant to our communities, however we define that. And if that instructor, if that professor can't make that connection, then they probably, in my opinion, don't belong in the classroom. Education is more to me than memorizing. That to me is not education. But being able to take these facts that we need to learn and being able to apply it. So if I know what a mathematical formula is, I should also be able to apply that. And if I don't know yet, as a first-year college student, that's the job of my college professor. So when I think of borderless classrooms, I think about what we're learning, the content, the lectures, what we're teaching, and how that applies to Kansas City, how that applies to Lawrence, how that applies to Washington, D.C., or tribal peoples around the world.
So for you, social media is something that removes some of the borders from the classroom.
Yes, we see studies where they talk about there's concern about use of social media, Facebook or Twitter or other ones that younger people are using, and that it might increase rates of depression. It might increase other negative moods and feelings and behaviors. But I don't know if they're asking the right types of questions, because for other people, at least anecdotally, making those connections does increase our world.
So you did this tweet along in January where you invited your entire school community, but it actually extended beyond your school community, to join you in your day-to-day wrestling with questions as someone working in academia, as someone working to make the experience of students at a tribal college everything it can be. Why did you do that?
There were a couple of reasons. One is, as I've mentioned before, this attack that I'm starting to see on higher education in general. And I wanted to put a face to the type of work that I do. I'm not representing Haskell. I'm representing a part of Haskell. So I wanted to, what we say, demystify what the role of a dean is. This is kind of the day-to-day work that we do. And I wanted to be able to show that how accessible administration can be, regardless of whether it's Haskell or another university.
And can you tell me about maybe a conversation you were able to have by doing that you don't think would have happened in another way?
Not offhand. This is something that I plan to do like every 6 weeks or so, because I do have to find a day where that this tweet along will work. Obviously, I can't tweet during all my meetings or if there's a last minute emergency that comes up.
That might be frowned upon.
Yes. And so I'm connected with students from other tribal colleges and also students and administrators who not only work at other tribal colleges, but colleges particularly up north of First Nations and in Canada. And so in a way, we're able to compare notes with each other. What's the experience up there? What's the experience down here?
Do your notes compare? What is the experience of someone at Haskell compared to someone at a tribal college in another region right now?
Well, in Lawrence, you can say that we're very fortunate in Lawrence because of the type of community that it strives to be. There are, obviously, there are issues as there are other places as far as issues with police and community interactions, interactions between the communities that might identify as white with people who might identify as American Indian, African American. And the interesting thing about Lawrence, from my perspective, is that the community is willing to address those difficult conversations and have those difficult dialogues. There are places in the United States or in Canada that we might not see that as much.
You say on your Twitter profile that you are unapologetically tribal. What do you mean by that?
I love tribalism, and that might be shocking because when people hear the word tribalism, they've been taught that that's a negative word, that it's a pejorative, and which is very interesting in the United States considering how many American Indian tribes that we have here and considering that this is an indigenous area. And it could just be our definitions of tribalism. When I think of tribalism, I think of our, what we can call our original instructions. Every tribe has their creation story. And so we think about that and how we are adhering to our original instructions. I also think about self-determination, sovereignty, and I also think about respectful coexistence. When I think about the days ahead, with regards to how climate change is going to affect our cities and affect our little towns, I think that one way that we might handle climate change is looking at how tribal communities operated in the past, how we functioned in the past, and this might be very helpful as we start thinking about our sustainability.
When you say unapologetically tribal, though, I wonder if you do feel cultural pressure to be apologetic about that.
That's another good question, and I might be a little bit more defensive just because growing up, hearing all this negativity about tribes and tribalism, and that word unapologetically comes up from a conversation I had with a CIA recruiter who came to campus, and she was talking about some work I had done in the Middle East with doing some comparative work with tribes over there. And she was talking about Afghanistan then and how when U.S. forces go over there, they're not always, they don't understand tribes. They don't understand tribalism and really can make some problems arise. So we were talking about how to get past that. And she said, how come these tribes over there are undermining democracy or the United States? And I said, well, perhaps we could reverse the question. How come those types of forces are undermining tribalism around the world? There's no reason to.
As someone who works at Haskell, but who has worked at KU, and, you know, seeing Lawrence as a college town, but one that's most closely linked to a lot of people with that relationship with KU, the flagship state school. But Haskell is there too and has a presence, but one that maybe people recognize a little less in the general community. Do you think that there is some work to be done there?
There's quite a bit of work to be done there. And I can say in the nearly 15 years I've been at Haskell that Lawrence has done, coming along in their recognition and relationship with Haskell, and we're seeing a younger generation of business owners who understand the importance of the relationship. Lawrence is very lucky to have the flagship university, but also a tribal college. Not many communities can brag about that.
Julia Goodfox, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia's a dean at Haskell Indian Nations University, and she's on Twitter, as we have mentioned. Her handle is @Goodfox. If you want to keep up with her thoughts and observations, next, looking back on the life of a Cuban artist with an exhibit now at the Kemper. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going to talk about the life of a Cuban artist whose work is currently on view at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art. Her name is Belkis Ayón, and she died young in 1999. But in the course of her short life, she made a mark in the art world with her striking singular vision, her printmaking technique, and her perspective on mythologies behind gender and race identity in Cuba. This exhibit that's in Kansas City right now is the first full retrospective of Belkis Ayón's work since she died. So let's hear her story now. Yesenia Fernandez Celier is going to start us off. She is with us from New Jersey. Hi, Yesenia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You are a dancer and performer originally from Cuba. You've done a lot of work in Latin American and Caribbean studies, both in Cuba and in the U.S., but I want you to start by telling us about your first encounter with Belkis Ayón's work.
I think it was around 1991 or 92 when I discovered her work in one of the international Cuban biennials that happened in Havana. And it was really striking. It was very different. I remember, like, I stand in front of the painting that I think it was one of the last supers. It's a high scale printing, and after 5 minutes, I decide to look in the title, and then when I realized what the work was about, I was like, oh my God, this is like really impressive and unique. Who is this woman? No?
Tell me more about the work you were looking at. And first of all, what you were seeing for the 5 minutes before you looked at the title, and then what the title told you that you hadn't realized.
She one of the higher scales paintings she did, like her first big scale works were the super, now that have certainly a connection, a representation or a dialogue, you know, with the Last Supper, with the Christian Last Supper. But certainly the characters in this painting are Black people. And also like the figure of Sican, that is the only female character that she ever depicted. Is also present, you know, as part of the Last Supper. So it's a kind of I don't know. It have like a multi-level of meanings here, no. But it's because the Supper, yes, certainly people is eating. I remember the images of the fish is present, but it's also marking the moment of death. The Christ death, but in this case, the Sican, the woman character death as well.
So we need to talk about who Sican is. She's a princess in the founding legend of a fraternal organization in Cuba. And this organization is sort of part religion, but also part professional organization. Can you explain this?
The Abaqua tradition in Cuba is, let's say, is incorporated as a male fraternity. But the cultural environment it came out in Africa. There were these organizations for men and for women as well in Africa, but in the when they came to Cuba, there was a crisis for free men to get jobs. So the incorporation of this fraternity was something that helped them to become economical agents around the ports of Havana and Matanzas. But as many of the Afro-Cuban traditions, these became ritualized as well. Now, so incorporate a lot of religious elements in a process of initiation, no? And so in that way, it kept aspects of the traditional history and also mythological aspects from Africa, but it has a sociological impact in Cuban society as well. But I think what makes this practice so central to Berquizayón's work is precisely that from the outside, you just can see the masculinity in motion. You can see the performance and the performativity of masculinity. But like looking from the outside, that is the only way in that non-practitioner women, you know, can look at this practice. It never occurs to you that a female character is at the core of this tradition. It's at the core of the practice.
Yeah, so there is the story.
Yes.
At the heart of it, that involves this princess character. But Belkisayon's work recasts her really as this, well, not necessarily recasts her. Can you tell, first of all, just tell the story that we're talking about and help us understand who this character is, who she was obsessed with, this princess character?
Yes. Well, and then the foundational myth of Abakwa recall a moment of war in El Calaban, that is a region to the eastern part of Nigeria. And the situation was these two main tribes, the Efik and the Efok, that was fighting each other for a considerable amount of time. But they both believe in Abasi, that it was the supreme god. And Sikang was a princess of the Efik, and she discovered by chance playing in the river, getting water for the house course, Abasi manifested to her. In the form of a fish, no, and this was a trouble moment for the I don't know, the leaders of the tribes, you know, because there was like the question of, okay, what are we going to do, and how this woman, you know. How the fish revealed to a woman instead of one of the leaders, no? So the thing is, like, I don't know if it was in the path from the river to her house, the fish died, no? And so it was like a moment of not only political crisis, but also like a sort of a mythical crisis, not the death of this avatar of Abasi. The resolution was, they started doing a lot of stuff to revive, the fish. The fish, you know, was dead. So they ended up deciding to sacrifice Sikan, to
the
recreate,
princess.
Yeah, the princess to if not bring the avatar, of Abasi back, at least being able to recreate the voice, no, because it has like a particular sound that it does when it's alive. Sikan became this magical ingredient, no, that allowed those two groups, Efik Efok, to keep their connection with God. But again, I think what is striking is the fact that from the outside you just see men in action, but at the core of Abakwa, because Sikang is considered like the mother of Abakwa, like something like without her sacrifice was impossible to have the confirmation of this fraternity.
You know, did Belkisayón, the artist whose work is on view now at the Kemper, did mm-hmm. seeing her work change how you viewed this story, this fraternal organization, its role in Cuba?
No, it do not. I think and it's not the right there at Kemper at the entrance of the exhibit. There is a fantastic interview that Ines Anselmi did to Belki Sayong when she was alive, like inquiring about her research, the sources that inspire her work. And she, Belki's very clearly, you know, says that she took on the Abaqua practice because she realized, like, considering the wide spectrum of Afro-Cuban religious traditions, the Abaqua was the only one that did not have like a steady iconography. No, there was not much of an artistic production regarding the Abaqua. So and it's true, but also I think this is a question or a commentary that has to do with, you know, how artists produce. No, I think, like, pretty much she took on the myth of Sikang first of all to make a commentary, a political and social commentary about the place of Black womanhood in the context of society, in the context of the Cuba of the 1990s and 80s, making a commentary also in terms of our absence in history and our invisibility. I think, like, from the very beginning, I realized that this was Belki's vision, no? This was an artistic decision of her that is something that is beyond the tradition, no? It's something that is inspired in the tradition, but is not a direct reflection of what the tradition is. I don't know if this answers your question.
In her work, you see that giant images that are made up of smaller squares that all fit together like a puzzle, and the figures in them are very starkly black or white or gray for the most part. And mm-hmm. the black figures have no nose and no mouth, but bright white eyes. And I'm curious, you know, you were just talking about Black womanhood in Cuba and invisibility. How do you see those figures?
I think she was, and precisely that's why I insist, no, that she was making a commentary. She was inspired by the myth, but she was doing a wider commentary about the humanity, about the universal, no, and also about race and gender, because this is the Abaqua tradition is this, the aspect of the secret, no, the secrecy of the organization, the secrecy of initiation, and at some point even the secrecy in that they have kept the Sikan myth, no, and Sikan roles for their own existence, no, is fundamental. So, but also I know because I live, I came out of the same sociological context of Belki's. I can tell, you know, the problems of expressing yourself or complaints in the context of socialist Cuba. It's like everybody at some point, men and women, or in this case, Sikan, are witness of what's going on, a witness of destiny, witness of history, but they have their limits to be agents or to manifest, to say exactly what they think or how they feel.
If you have been to the Kemper and seen this exhibit by Cuban artist Belki Sayong, you're welcome to call in with your questions about her life and her story or her art at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about a retrospective of Cuban printmaker Belkis Ayón at the Kemper Museum right now. We've been speaking with Yesenia Fernandez Celier. She is a scholar and performer who's worked in both the United States and Cuba. She works in the United States right now, and she's speaking with us from New York. And now I'd like to bring Laura Berman in on this conversation. She's a printmaking professor at the Kansas City Art Institute, and she will be leading a tour of the exhibit next month. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. So take us back to the beginning. Who is Belkis Ayón? What is her story as you know it?
Belkis Ayón is a masterful artist. I have only become familiar with her work since last fall when I began researching in preparation to be part of the show and to help educate the docents and lead a tour and also teach a workshop at the Kemper. As far as I know, she's everything that Yesenia has already said. She's an Afro-Cuban artist. She's a contemporary printmaker. She has really broken the mold in terms of what she does with her technique. Sure. She works with large-scale collagraph printmaking, which only a few people have ever done. Collagraph was invented in like the 1910s to 1930s. And it was invented as a printmaking medium that was resourceful. So it would use scrap metal that was soldered together, sewn together, kind of fused together, because resources were hard to find during the World Wars. And eventually, collagraph evolved to include things like less expensive materials like cardboard, cut up paper, gesso, cheap paint, things that you could just impress textures on or create textures with easily. Belkis uses things like vegetable peels and chipboard and pretty low-tech materials to put her plates together. What's remarkable about her work is that she works in this very low-tech way on such a large scale. So she's working modularly to put her images together with so much precision and so much it's just mastery, the way she knows how to work with her ink. She knows how to apply the ink to the paper. To the plate, to then print it on the paper, to get the tonal range that she gets and just the depth to her work, just using black.
Talk to me about her level of recognition within the art world before she died.
Sure. She, from what I understand, she was beginning to gain a lot of recognition in the last 5 to 10 years. So about the exhibition at the Kemper is a 10-year body of work. So sort of in that last half of that body of work, her prints were exhibiting internationally. She was achieving prizes. She was being invited into biennials and lots of international exhibitions. She was gaining, even in the context that Yesenia has described, she was gaining a lot of notoriety for her technique and for her content with her imagery, even though she was really challenging the norms.
Yesenia, talk to me a little bit in terms of just, you were saying before that that women in the Afro-Cuban tradition have felt silenced at points, and that here's this woman telling a story in many ways about that being heard and seen on the international scale. What does that mean to you?
Belkis Ayón produced a vision of Abaqua and Abaqua mythology and Abaqua a female character that is completely absent, no, in the open of in the what you can see of the practices, but it is a complex issue because I don't think we black women feel like really absence in the context of traditions, no? There are several Afro-Cuban practices in Cuba. Abaqua is only one of them. Women have a limited presence there, but they are hyperactive in other aspects and in other contexts, like, for example, Santeria or Palo or Arara. These are traditions that women carry a lot of the leadership, a lot of the structure, a lot of the practices that have helped these traditions to survive for two centuries is something that have been done by women mostly. So the context of absence and invisibility is not inside the tradition. But I have to say that if we look at the Cuban history, for example, or Cuban art history, there are not that many women out there, and even less Afro-Cuban women. And I think, like, for Belkis Ayón to take on the path of becoming an artist, and in particular this team, she felt very alone. She was kind of isolated, not in the reception, but in the production. And probably I can say with no doubts that Belkis Ayón is the most important Afro-Cuban artists that have ever existed so far. They are like a couple of new artists that are alive and producing today, like María Magdalena Campos Pons, Juana Valdez, and others that are really good. But I think considering the amount of time in that Belkis Ayón produced her work and died, with only 32 years old, you know, she achieved something that nobody ever, no other Afro-Cuban women have ever been in that place in Cuban art history. So the solitude, no, of being her, is something that I can relate. There were not that many people with the level of recognition. And probably, you know, it was shocking for her to realize that, you know, that she was actually achieving a place and an interest that nobody ever mastered to attract before. No,
can you also talk to me a little bit about the role of race in her story? I mean, the materials from the Kemper describe her as a Black woman, as a Black artist. Is that how she would have identified herself?
I never met her, but I can tell for the selection of her theme, no, that she was in an exploration of her own identity and certainly a history, you know, or even like at some point reflecting of looking for a different narrative beyond the political narrative of revolution and socialism, you know, to reflect about her own identity. Also, many times, I don't know, she have like African braids, you know, so I think like she has like certain, she have clarity of the politics of representation and the politics of race personally and also through her work.
Is there a different, how do people see African roots in Cuba?
Well, that's another complex question, and it's a complex answer because I think it's very easy to see the practices or folkloric expression. I say folkloric, like quote unquote. I'm not so happy with the definition, but you can see it all over the place. You know, there are like more companies that work about Afro-Cuban tradition, Afro-Cuban roots in terms of dance and music today than ever before. But the emphasis in the performance and the visibility that those performances are having in Cuban society today doesn't mean that people truly understand the philosophical aspects, the theological aspects that underline those practices. So what is happening is a sort of a spectacularization of the tradition, but most people don't go deeper, you know, to understand what are those performances about.
Our time is sadly up, but Yesenia Fernandez Celier, scholar, performer, this has been so interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Laura Berman with us from KCAI. I would love to have heard more from you, but you are leading a tour on April 11th, so people can hear more from you about the technical aspects of Belki Sayon's work. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. And check out our new season of Midwesternish, a podcast for people who heart the heartland, even though it's complicated. Subscribe to it, you guys. It's good stuff. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.